Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC, and we'll spend some time now with one of New York City's great muckraking journalists, Daily News columnist Juan Gonzalez. The occasion is his 25th anniversary with the news. Some of you also know him from his broadcast work on Pacifica's Democracy Now! The recent Daily News headline celebrating Juan's career there puts it this way: from Crown Heights brutality to the $500 million city time fraud, Juan Gonzalez recalls 25 years of his greatest scandalous scoops. So let's do some of that recalling. We'll take him all the way back to his high school newspaper and all the way up to the city today in this mayoral election year. Juan, welcome back to WNYC and congratulations on 25 years.
Oh,
really.
Thank you, Brian. It's my pleasure to be here.
And if we're going to go back, let's go way back. You were born in Puerto Rico, grew up in Brooklyn and East Harlem, yes?
Yes, yeah. I grew up in first in East Harlem and then in the East New York section of Brooklyn.
And I read you worked on your high school newspaper. Did you know you wanted to be a journalist even as a teenager?
Yes, pretty much, because I had a great journalism teacher at Frank and K. Lane High School, and we had a great newspaper at that time, the Lane Reporter. And she insisted that I was going to be the editor of the paper in her senior year. So she started training me for my sophomore year, prepare for that.
It's nice to have a mentor when you're that young, right? Do you remember any of your high school stories? Were you muckraking about the principal?
Well, we didn't do too much outside coverage. I would say that the biggest story probably that we dealt with was in my senior year, which was 1964 at Lane High School, and that was the year of the great public school boycott led by Milton Glamison and Malcolm X, and protesting racial inequities in the public school system. And I remember then being a conservative Catholic writing an editorial opposing the boycott, saying they had some just issues, but the idea of keeping kids out of school and the parents keeping their kids out of school just didn't sit well with me.
Did you see yourself as conservative at that young age? Were
yes,
your parents conservative?
I was raised a Catholic, an altar boy, and at St. Fortunatus Church, and for many years, so many social issues at that time. I thought of myself much more as a conservative. Yes.
You then went to Columbia, and I guess you first became a public figure during the 1968 student protests that shut down the university. For our listeners who were too young to remember, what was important about that protest at that time for you?
Well, I think that the Columbia student strike of 68 was probably one of the biggest in American university history, along with the Berkeley movement, of course, and the San Francisco State strike that happened. That's a little later in the fall of 68. But the Columbia strike, I think it was important because it dealt with sort of the two big social issues of our time, which was racism within the university and the university's continued expansion into the Harlem community, taking up land, and specifically centered on a gym that the university was building in Morningside Park, in a public park, but which would have had a back entrance for the community and a front entrance and most of the use for the students and the faculty of the university. And so that was a major issue. And then also the other big issue was the Vietnam War. The Students for Democratic Society was very active on the campus at the time. Of course, Mark Rudd was the famous leader of SDS at the time. And SDS was very much involved in opposing the university's research for the Institute for Defense Analysis that was doing a lot of work on the Vietnam War. And so all of us who were in the university at that time got involved, myself more through the gym issue, and then of course, we had the big strike to take over of five buildings, hundreds of people arrested, and the shutdown for 6 weeks of the university in the spring of that year.
And you then went on to be a leader of the New York branch of the Young Lords Party, whose causes were neighborhood empowerment and self-determination for Puerto Rico, often seen in those days, or at least characterized in those days, as kind of a Hispanic equivalent of the Black Panthers Party, which had come first. Is that how you saw it?
That was pretty much, I would say, that was accurate. We saw ourselves very much in the mold of not only the the Black Panther Party, but also of the Nationalist Party of Puerto Rico, the big pro-independence group of the 30s, 40s, and 50s on the island. And we were inspired by both of those movements. And so, to a large degree, the Lords did have the same sort of impact and role in the Puerto Rican and Latino community that the Panthers had. Of course, several of the former Young Lords, including myself, then went on to careers in journalism. They included, well, Geraldo Rivera, who was our lawyer at the time. He was not a member, but he was one of our most outspoken and publicly known lawyers. And, of course, Pablo Guzman, who still is a reporter at WCBS, has been there, I think, for about 30 years. And
Felipe Luciano.
Felipe, who was Luciano, who was our chairman, then went on to become a WNBC and a Fox reporter for many years, and now is with WBAI Radio again. So, quite a few of the original leadership of the group ended up in the media.
So, in other words, after you graduated Columbia, you thought, should I stay here and go to the Columbia J School or join the Young Lords to get my start in journalism? No, I'm just kidding.
We did actually have a paper too at the Young Lords. It was called Palante. It was a weekly paper that had, I guess, about at its height, about its circulation, about 25,000. Several of us took turns. Pablo was the first editor. I later became an editor. We all took turns editing that newspaper as well. So that was on-the-job training, I'd say.
One other historical sidelight about that that I, probably wouldn't have even thought to bring up, except that there's this new gun law debate these days. And there was that article, op-ed in the Times by David Cole, which recalled how the Black Panthers, when they believed in black people legally arming themselves in self-defense against the state just in case, that led to gun control laws at the time, like one that Ronald Reagan signed as governor of California, because white leaders were afraid and wanted to make it harder for Black Panthers to get legal guns. Did the Young Lords have that side too?
Yes, we also supported the right of armed self-defense in the Puerto Rican community, and we actually did in those days weapons training for our members as well. And I think generally speaking, we did see the efforts at gun control then more aimed at the minority communities, than they are in the general population of the United States, because you go to the suburbs, the rural areas of America, and Americans are armed to the teeth.
Indeed.
And it's only in the cities, really, that gun control is a major concern of the political establishment.
So how'd you wind up at the Daily News?
Well, I had gone in the sort of the latter period of the Young Lords. I had moved to Philadelphia, and I had gone to work in a variety of factories and printing plants in Philadelphia in the 70s. But then sort of by the end of the 70s, I'd gotten married, and my wife was saying, what are you doing? You have a college education. What are you doing working in a factory? We need to make some more money. So I finally decided at that period of time to try to go back to my first love of journalism. I began, actually managed to get a job at the Philadelphia Daily News in the late 1970s as a news clerk initially, but then was quickly promoted to reporter. And so I spent several years at the Philadelphia Daily News covering all the various beats, environment, the labor movement, public education for 2 years, then city hall and city government. And then, as luck would have it, in the late 80s, my former editor-in-chief at the Philadelphia Daily News, Gil Spencer, was hired as the editor-in-chief at the New York Daily News. And after a couple of years there, he started trying to woo me to come back because he knew about my history in New York. I knew a lot of people and I knew the city. And I think the Daily News was also under a lot of pressure at that time in the late 1980s, because that's when they had the big racial discrimination lawsuit that the Daily News lost. So they were looking to also sort of diversify their news staffs. And so Gil kept bugging me to try to come back to New York, and I did. So I came back in December of 1987. As a columnist at the paper.
And listeners, we can take phone calls for Juan Gonzalez on this occasion, officially a few weeks ago, of his 25th anniversary as a Daily News columnist. Anything about Juan Gonzalez stories that you've read over the years? We'll also talk about the state of the city today. I don't know if columnists give state of the city addresses, but, you know, I guess they do 600 words at a time. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or post to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. And there are different kinds of columnists, right? Ones who write mostly their opinions and ones who do a lot more reporting, like you. Were there some things going on in New York when you started in 87 that made you want to be an investigative reporter?
Well, I'd always sort of had, even when I was a beat reporter in Philadelphia, I'd always had sort of the interest in delving into stories that other people weren't covering. And, you know, because there's, to my mind, there's two kinds of reporters in the world: the reporters who get stories handed to them by their editors and the ones who find their own stories. It was my experience early on that my editors were not going to hand me stories, so that I had to dig them up myself. So I began really early on sort of investigating issues, especially since I knew I was going to be writing and reporting in big cities. I sort of carved out a niche for myself into looking at what was happening to city policies and also land development policies, because in urban America, what any government does with its land is a big part of the vision of its leaders and what kind of a community they want. So I would say I've for now more than 20 years have sort of carved out for myself looking into how government functions and what it does with its land, both in Philadelphia, and I had some of my biggest scoops or investigative stories in Philadelphia, also having to do with city land policy. And I've tried to continue that here in New York, because nobody else pays attention to this stuff. And unfortunately, these huge land projects that get developed, the politicians who start them are long gone when they're finished. The reporters who started to cover them are long gone when they actually come to fruition. And no one ever remembers what the promises were to the people about all the money that was spent on all these projects. So if you stay with projects long enough and you have institutional memory and you dig deep enough, you'll come up with stories that nobody even imagined were there.
The 25-year retrospective article includes the idea that people frequently give you tips, mostly whistleblowers and victims of injustice. One example is probably the worst scandal of the Bloomberg era, the City Time payroll scandal. Who tipped you off to what?
Well, the original tip, I have no idea who it was, because it was an anonymous tip and it came in an envelope with no return address, no name, no nothing. It was just a list of a bunch of people who were working as consultants to the city on the City Time project and the salaries that they were making. And they were phenomenal salaries. One of them turned out to be what the federal authorities have called the ringleader, or the most massive fraud in the city's history. So I immediately started asking around about this City Time project and talked to one of our City Hall reporters, and she said to me, "Oh, yeah, I wrote about that a couple of years ago, and I think the price had gone way up, and it wasn't finished." And sure enough, when I started digging, not only had the price gone up, it had gone out exponentially. And the project was over 8 years behind schedule and barely a third completed. As I wrote about it, more whistleblowers came forward, former consultants who had worked on the project, who were disgusted at the fraud and the shell companies. Eventually, I had maybe about a dozen different whistleblowers all coming to me. So I continued to write about it. Eventually, the authorities, both the city's Department of Investigation and the U.S. Attorney's Office, really launched major criminal probes. And since then, they've indicted 11 people in the scheme, and a couple have already pled guilty, and the others are awaiting trial. But most importantly, the major contractor, SAIC, a major defense contractor in the country, agreed to repay $500 million to the city because of all of the fraud that occurred under its watch. And two major executives of of SAIC who were in charge of City Time were both not only fired but indicted.
And here's Mayor Bloomberg from 2010 when he himself had to come out on the scandal that had taken place on his watch.
Here we had somebody that we trusted or one of our contractors trusted, and that trust was misplaced, and we just have no tolerance for this whatsoever.
So let me go from one of the more recent examples that in your work to the oldest example in your retrospective column, which is the story that dates back to the Crown Heights riots of 1991 when police arrested and beat a non-rioter, a Haitian immigrant, who was literally just driving by. How did you get wind of that?
Well, that was a I think that's one of the really amazing stories that I've covered in the time I've been here. One day I get a call at the newspaper from a lawyer by the name of Glenn Miller, who I had worked with in a previous story I had written about police abuse. And Glenn says, Juan, I have a client who was badly beaten by the police the night of the Crown Heights riot. And he was just driving through the neighborhood. He was from White Plains, and he was lost driving back from a relative's. And he happened to get onto President Street while people were throwing rocks at police. He panicked. He tried to drive down the street very quickly. The police stopped his car. A whole group of police yanked him out and beat him to a pulp and then arrested him. And so I have a CCRB complaint, a civilian complaint review board complaint against the police, and I've also asked Internal Affairs to look into it. And I need your help because I'm told that a late edition of the Daily News that the following day had a photo of my client being labeled as a rioter and with two policemen holding him, and I need to identify those cops because I need to find out who were the cops that were involved in the beating. So I told him, well, Glenn, you know, I can't help you. I mean, if the photo was published in the paper, I could tell you where you can get a copy of the paper. But other than that, I really can't assist you in your efforts to get more evidence. You know, I can only tell you what's in the public record, which is in the paper. So he says, well, would you do me a favor and see if you could find if it's true that the photo was there? So I go and I look, and sure enough, there was a photo in a late edition of the paper, and it was his client. But then just on a hunch, I talked to one of my fellow colleagues, or a photographer at the paper, and I said to him, listen, can you help me find the film of this incident? Because obviously if we had a photographer who took one photo, the photographer probably took more than one photo. And so so he helped me. We went back into our library. We found the film. In those days, it was still film, the negatives of this incident. And I was shocked to find that not only that there was a running number of photos that had the entire detail of the incident, but also that someone had gone into our library and cut out the four negatives that precisely showed him being beaten.
Wow.
Because there were missing negatives in the group of photos.
So sometimes the journalists have good contacts with the police, and sometimes the police have good contacts with the journalists.
With the journalists, exactly. And I was stunned by that. So I said I said to him, listen, you know, I said to Miller, I can't there are other photos here, but I can't give them to you, and you're going to have to figure out what you can do to get them. So he eventually, luckily he had a very good internal affairs investigator who was determined to find out what had happened, and the internal affairs investigator came and got the photos, and there was a police captain involved in the beating, and as a result, Miller went to trial in a lawsuit against the city, and I think it was $3 million or so for his client. But it took about 7 years or 8 years.
And these things often take that long. But he got about a $3 million payout.
Yes, he did, and again, my columns, I wrote about two or three of them on the Pierre Regis case, and they were the only stories in the city written about this case.
So these are both City Time and this. Great examples of journalism having an impact, because people were indicted in the one case. Here, there was an internal affairs investigation. Restitution was paid to the victim. And you wrote in this retrospective column that the stories you chose for your anniversary piece were mostly those that end with financial justice for the victims or the taxpayers. And I guess that's got to be the best feeling a journalist can have, when you know that original reporting that you have done – has made a difference in policy or in some financial justice. Is that the ultimate accomplishment for you?
Well, I think it definitely is a proof that the work I've been doing has had some impact. I've actually, I believe, done bigger stories that never achieved real justice. Mm-hmm. But these at least were decided usually in a court of law or by a controller's investigation, and there is no doubt of what happened in the case. And others, you know, there were stories that I still believe to this day were major stories, but for instance, never had the same kind of results, end game, where the people who were aggrieved found some measure of justice, or where the taxpayers were recompensed for what occurred.
After the break, I want to get your take on New York City today in this mayoral election year and what you think of the 12-year Bloomberg legacy. Listeners, want to talk to Juan Gonzalez about any of his daily news columns from the past 25 years or his broadcast work or New York City Today, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or post to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show, and we'll continue in a minute. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and we continue with Juan Gonzalez, who just hit 25 years as a muckraking daily news columnist. Many of you also know him from Democracy Now!, and let's take a call. Megan in Jackson, New Jersey, you're on the air. Hi, Megan.
Hi, great. Thank you so much. I'm so proud to be the first caller. Juan Gonzalez, I listen to Democracy Now! All the time. I'm very upset when I miss the broadcast, and I just want to say, for one, congratulations on your recovery. I'm glad to hear that you are healing well after your back injury. I'm suffering from the same situation. And I just wanted to congratulate you and how much you're greatly appreciated. I'm in Jackson, New Jersey, and am a new BAI listener for about a little bit over a year, and I listen to it all the time. The radio is on constantly, and when we got rid of the TV, all we depended on was the radio. We have no internet, no nothing. So thank you so much for true free speech and truly unbiased reporting. And it should be absolute criteria on public service and even in public schools. More people should really listen to what is really going on as opposed to what is covered by the corrupt and biased media. And on the stop and frisk, Occupy Wall Street, the environment, what's going on all over the world, and especially with the surveillance system that is now the norm
everywhere. Megan, I'm gonna leave it there and get some other folks on.
And
thank you.
Thank you for your call.
But let me follow up on her, because you work for Democracy Now! On Pacifica, obviously, as well as the Daily News. Very different news organizations with very different audiences.
Very different audiences.
Do you see your mission as different in the two places?
Yes, I think so. I mean, obviously, the Daily News has always been geared to working class New Yorkers, but it's always had a very conservative editorial and slant on the news. And whereas Pacifica and the Democracy Now! Have always been much more progressive, radical, alternative news, and the audience is very different. So I think that in both places, I think I can function because of the sources I have, the information that I've been able to gather over the years, and the institutional memory, I guess, that you get after being in the same place in the same city for so long.
The muckraking columnist Jack Newfield was once on this show just after he lost his column at the Daily News in one of the shakeups.
Yes, a great friend of mine, yes.
And I said, you could go back to the Village Voice where you first made your mark. I'm sure they'd love to have you. And he said, yeah, but in the Voice, I only reach a certain progressive audience, not the working class readership that I have at the Daily News. Both are really important to me. And he actually, as you know, went to the New York Post after that. Do you ever have a similar feeling about being in, you know, a mainstream, sometimes conservative paper like the News and the importance of that?
Oh, sure, because you see it every day in the phone calls and emails that you get when half or sometimes more of the audience is furious at you for your positions. And the threats that come at you, the anger, the vitriol of people who disagree with you. But you're exposed to a different perspective and different viewpoint, and I think that helps sharpen your understanding of what are the issues that impact the general society.
Rich on Staten Island. You're on WNYC with Juan Gonzalez. Hi.
Yes, hi. First of all, I'd like to thank Juan Gonzalez for his coverage of the Verizon strike. He did 2-3 columns about that strike and really portrayed us in a true light, as opposed to other media outlets who portrayed the workers as being greedy because we didn't want to pay for our medical benefits to a profitable corporation. And I think you really framed Verizon for what they were. And I'd really like to thank you for that.
Well, thank you. And again, that's another issue where it didn't curry much favor with my editors because Verizon, of course, is a major advertiser in the New York Daily News.
Did you hear about it?
Yes. And in fact, Verizon complained directly, and they had to put more ads in the paper to counter some of my columns. But I think that when it comes to issues of that affect working New Yorkers, I try to in my column in the paper, try to raise the perspective and the viewpoint of the workers themselves, not just the owners of the companies or the managers in cases of city government.
So we've been talking about some of your earlier columns. Let's talk about some of your recent ones. In fact, I think I see a direct connection between the oldest example we talked about, your story about the bystander or driving bystander who was arrested during Crown Heights riot and beaten, and your most recent column this week about the court ruling on stop and frisk, which is about innocent bystanders being stopped by the police, unconstitutional, says the federal court. Think this will be a major issue in the mayoral race?
I think it's going to continue to be an issue, if only because there are so many New Yorkers that are affected on a daily basis by the stop and frisk policies. And sooner or later, when the policies become too abusive, you have major incidents that sort of highlight them. And just as the Amadou Diallo incident did it in the heyday of what was then called the Street Crimes Unit, which was sort of an unscientific approach to stop and frisk. Now it's actually scientifically done, the stop and frisk.
Really? What do you mean by scientific?
Well, in terms of that it's systemic and massive, you know, whereas the street crimes unit were in certain neighborhoods, now the level of intensity of stop and frisk when you have 600,000, 700,000 people stopped a year is really now at it's a mass production, you know, a mass production level. And so I think that sooner or later you're going to have tragic incidents, unfortunately, that are going to highlight to the rest of the city that you cannot keep stopping people, especially young people, on such a regular basis and demeaning them and disrespecting them and then expect to have police community relations on a sound footing.
On another of your recent columns, folks, I ran into Juan at the movies on Christmas Day. Remember?
Yes.
He was in the men's room. I was seeing Lincoln. He was seeing Promised Land. And voila, there was a column about the film in the News last week. So here's a clip from the trailer that I think, Juan, sets up what you wrote about, which is not, you know, water catching on fire like in Gasland, but the issue of taking land.
You guys have closed more towns than the team behind you by triple digits. How do you do that?
I grew up in a large farming community. Tractor pulls, cow tipping. We had a caterpillar plant. My junior year, they closed it down. And that whole farming town fantasy was just shattered. I'm selling them the only way they have to get back.
I am happy to announce we will be bringing natural gas to McKinley.
So a clip from the trailer for Promised Land. This film has gotten so-so reviews, but you called it a must-see for Governor Cuomo.
Yeah. Yes, because the governor is facing a major decision in the next few days on what to do about hydraulic fracturing or fracking in New York State. And those of us who live in the big cities don't realize what a major issue this is in the heartland of America, because there has been, in essence, a gold rush. Chesapeake Energy calls it on its own website its strategy of a land grab to buy up as many leases for natural gas drilling as they can in rural areas.
The words land grab?
Yes, they use the word land grab. Go to their website. And Chesapeake Energy is the number two company in this hydraulic fracturing endeavors. So that what you have is you have a situation where all across America, these companies, energy companies, are buying up land for the potential of natural gas natural gas drilling. And there are battles in all of these rural communities, what to do with our land. And there are, of course, many of those communities, especially in upstate New York, are economically depressed. And when someone comes around, as Matt Damon does in the movie, it offers all of this instant wealth. It really creates a major political battle in all of these small towns. And upstate New York, this is a big issue.
Right.
Whereas down here in the city, people don't pay much attention to it at all.
Right. And the shale revolution is here for natural gas and oil. It's happening all over the country. And these rural battles that we don't hear about. I mean, other states are actually, from other things that I've read, not wringing their hands as much as New York, for better or for worse. They say it'll make the U.S. a net energy exporter in just a few years, which could be transformational to our economy, to our foreign policy, not as much entanglement with the Middle East. Do you see your reporting on fracking as trying to get it to stop, or seeing that it's done with as little environmental damage and injustice as possible?
Well, I think the first step is to have an actual public debate over it, at least have an airing of the views on it, and also raise the warning that has happened so often with new technologies, that the long-term impacts of these new technologies are not yet known, and therefore that there's got to be a sort of a healthy skepticism whenever you enter into a new technology that can have potentially a major impact on our natural resources, especially our drinking water.
By the way, for listeners who are curious, my producer just looked up the Chesapeake Energy website, and here's the context for those words. We embarked on this aggressive land grab in 2000 as we recognized earlier than most of our competitors that vast new areas of the U.S. would open up for natural gas exploration. That was in a letter that they sent to shareholders in 2006. Yes. And a rare moment of candor,
right,
on the part of a major energy company. Let's take another phone call. Dennis in Norwalk. You're on WNYC. Hi, Dennis.
Hello, Brian. Big fan of yours, and I'd like to really thank Juan for all of his work, particularly his book, Harvest of Empire, History of Latinos in America. As a Puerto Rican man, I really respect and thank Juan for all the work he does, especially on Democracy Now!, which I think needs to have a wider audience. It's one of the finest daily news broadcasts in the country. I wish more people could hear the perspective of that show, which doesn't have the corporate sponsored media angle like your show, Brian. I love you. So thanks, Mr. Gonzalez. I really appreciate your work.
And thank you. Thank you for the call.
Rosemary in Princeton, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, Brian. At the expense of piling on, I did want to commend Juan on Harvest of Empires and his work on Democracy Now! It's just, I think it's the finest news program, although, Brian, you do a fabulous job yourself. And
thanks.
I just wanted to ask
we're not competing with each other, so.
What he thought the legacy of the Bloomberg administration would be long-term, either for better or worse, given the fact that we're coming up on the end of it. And thank you again so much. Really, Democracy Now! Is just an incredible program.
Rosemary, thank you. Bloomberg legacy. That's a big question.
Yeah, it is a big question, and it's hard to answer in a few words. And I've actually toyed with the idea of actually doing my next book on how Michael Bloomberg, the era of Bloomberg, changed urban America, especially New York City. But I would say that in summary, I would say that the Bloomberg era represented the final takeover of local government in New York City by the business class of New York. I can't think of a more class-driven government in the modern era of New York City than was the Bloomberg administration. Virtually everything that it does is from the perspective of how will it benefit the development of business. Bloomberg has done many good things on the social front, whether it's the smoking ban, the drinks.
Guns, he's the national leader of the gun control movement.
The gun control movement on bicycle lanes, which I think have been a really major advance in transportation in the city. So he's done a lot of good things. But the essential thing, I think, and what he's done, and I think what the city will be paying for years to come, is this sense that the main job of government is to make it easier for business to do business. And this sort of, whether it's demonization of working people, whether it's the teachers or the city workers or the transportation workers or any one of groups of work of people who work with their hands and don't have a lot of money, that there's been a constant demonization of labor in New York, that I think we're going to be feeling the impact of that for decades to come.
You feel he demonizes labor? Obviously, he's had his battles with the teachers union over evaluations and tenure and things like that. But in general, you think he demeans labor?
I could go through any group of workers. I mean, the transport workers union. Remember the strike of 2005, where basically the TWU had to basically push Bloomberg aside because he was so polarizing the conflict that they eventually were able to reach a deal with Governor Pataki and with the MTA, despite the constant attacks of Bloomberg on that union. The way he's dealt not only with the teachers, but to me, the most defenseless people of all are the non-professional public school employees, the part-time workers in the cafeterias, and who are constantly being made the victims of budget cuts more than any other group of workers in the city. His total reduction of the park worker force and his turning of our public parks into privately run groups, but by these various nonprofit alliances of wealthy New Yorkers who then, in essence, turned the parks into like private enclaves. So I think in many ways he sort of demonized public workers working people in general. Constantly defending, I mean, one of his friends who he constantly defends is the CEO of Con Edison, which has to be one of the most hated companies in New York. And he's constantly defending the work of Con Edison. I think it's a major, major problem in terms of the class basis of the Bloomberg government.
Just on one of those things, on the parks, I know his parks commissioners would say, look, all this private money that goes into things like the Central Park Conservancy, where there is a lot of money in the neighborhood, frees up more money in the Parks Department to be spent on parks in not so affluent neighborhoods.
Well, I would think if you saw that kind of the kind of development in some of the poorer neighborhoods that you do in the selected parks, whether it's the riverfront parks in Battery Park or Randall's Island or Central Park, you don't see that same kind of development, let's say in Van Cortlandt Park or Pelham Bay Park, or some of the other parks that are much more community used by the low income or working class communities of the city.
So as we start to run out of time, after 25 years of muckraking for the Daily News, is New York a better place than when you started in terms of justice and equality?
I think there's been progress. I mean, obviously the city has changed dramatically from the 1980s when I started writing a column here. The crime levels are down. But I think the part of the revitalization of the city has been the enormous immigrant flows that have really revitalized whole areas of the city. It was not just the policies, but it's the people themselves who have helped to rebuild New York City. And you know, we often give too much credit to the politicians at the top and too little credit to the people who are actually have to, like, live in these communities and make them better places. So I think, yes, there's been progress. But I think, unfortunately, that the wealth gap between Manhattan and the rest of the city has grown dramatically, and so there's the point that Manhattan has become almost like a private enclave compared to the rest of the city, and so that we still have major, major class divisions in the city that have not been diminished.
And at the same time that this wealth is being accumulated by some, the poverty rate's been going up for year after year. It's now 21% officially, as I'm sure you know,
yes,
of New York City residents living in poverty. And we sure think that should be a major issue in the mayoral race this year. But bottom line, last question, are you an optimist or more of a pessimist about the future?
Well, I'm always optimistic about that things can change. They don't always change for the better. But I do think that it's the most important thing people need is factual information and sunshine in the activities of their government officials. And that's what I keep trying to do. And hopefully we'll be able to do for a few more years.
Hopefully. Well, congratulations on 25 years at the Daily News and your work on Democracy Now. And thanks for coming in and having such a wide-ranging conversation
with
us.
Thank you. Thank you, Brian.
All right, listeners, quick question, snappy answer. What do you approve of more than Congress? The phones are open now, 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. And we asked because we saw this fantastic survey by Public Policy Polling that shows that Congress currently has a 9% approval rating. And that's very low. It's been around that low for several years now, so it's only kind of newsworthy. The poll went another step, though, and asked Americans to pit Congress against an increasingly ridiculous list of generally horrible things. So compare the approval rates for Congress versus root canals. 32% said Congress, 56% preferred the dental procedure. Congress versus the NFL replacement refs, 29% for Congress, 56% for those refs who couldn't seem to get a single call right. Head lice, 19% for Congress, 67% prefer having to check their kids and pull those little tiny bugs out of their heads. So call up with your quick answer. What do you approve of more than Congress? 212-433-WNYC. What do you approve of more than Congress? 212-433-9692. We can also take these on Twitter. This is a good one for Twitter because you can definitely do this in less than 140 characters. Use the hashtag approve of more than Congress, which is going to take up most of the characters anyway. So use the hashtag approve of more than Congress. Then after the break, we'll take your calls. We'll read some more things from the poll that Americans prefer to Congress and a few of the surprising things that Americans still don't like more than Congress. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692.